yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, this week we're going to take a general overview of various news, events, developments of interest here that have some staying value and that will have an impact in coming weeks and months. We've been talking a lot about central banks and I'll be talking more about that as the central banks have their global annual meeting coming up at Jackson Hole, Wyoming at the end of August. Also, my book on that central bank is at the end of their ropes. Monetary Policy in the Coming Depression is coming out here next week. So I'll be talking about some of the main themes of that, and maybe we'll actually say a few things that we have time at the end of the show. We have been talking about that a little bit as we talk about the general topic here for the last several shows here of central banks and what they represent. Well, what they really represent is a part of a shift that has occurred significantly in global capitalism since 2008-09. And a lot of my investigations are about, well, what is the character of that shift? Because it has certainly crossed the Rubicon of sorts. And we can now begin seeing elements of that. And it's important to understand that because that has very long-term consequences. And one of the themes of my book is that central banks now have undertaken a role, a new role, not just their traditional role of lender of last resort, in other words, bail out the banks when they get in trouble, or regulate the money supply, or supervise the private banking industry. Those are the major functions of central banks. But now, I am arguing since 2008-09, the main function and purpose of central banks is to continue to subsidize the financial system, particularly the commercial banks, which are in deep trouble everywhere. As the shadow banking world, or what's sometimes called capital markets, is beginning to eat the bank's lunch. That's not to say the banks are losing money, but it's getting harder and harder for them to do so, and they need to convert to shadow bank practices, or else the equity funds, private equity and hedge funds and all the other shadow banks are going to eat their lunch, which they are doing. And actually, the 2008-09 crash, we can see that that was partly due to what I just described. In other words, the shadow banks were becoming more and more influential in terms of controlling total assets and investment. And the private banks, the commercial banks, had to change and become more like the shadow banks themselves, which they were doing. And that meant establishing what they called off-balance sheet vehicles, financial subsidiaries, and so forth. And that's what got them in trouble when the crash actually came. Dragged them down. In other words, they had become blended, increasingly were becoming blended shadow banks themselves to survive. Part of the capitalist competition, you see, in the banking sector. Well, ever since then, we've had this token effort in the advanced economies to try to prevent that kind of integration or transformation of the commercial banks, the traditional banks, into being shadow banks, and engaging in highly speculative, risky investments. But it's only been token, and now it's being reversed. So we will be going back, I predict, to this this model that was evolving and led to the crash, where banks become more like funds, you see, and equity firms and so forth. You know, that's just the antithesis of what the Glass-Steagall bill was all designed to prevent back in the 1930s, because all this happened in the 1920s already, and it was clear to the Roosevelt administration reformers that they had to put a wall between commercial banks and non-commercial banks, because shadow banks, which existed then, because the latter were dragging down the rest of the banking system. Well, that existed for several decades after the Depression. But by the 1960s and 70s, the shadow banks, capital markets, particularly in the U.S., to some extent the U.K., began to reemerge again and grew. Once the gold standard, the Bretton Woods International Monetary Standard, completely collapsed in the 1970s, it was opening the door for further accelerating growth, which has happened. And as this has happened in the 1980s and on, an accelerating fashion, we get more and more financial instability and financial crises and so forth. And it all culminated, of course, in 2008-09. What we've seen since then is a futile attempt to prevent this long-run capitalist finance banking trend. And now we're with the repeal underway of in the U.S. of the Dodd-Frank bill, being driven by Goldman Sachs, you see. Steve Mnuchin, Goldman Sachs, runs the Treasury now. And Bill Dudley, New York Fed, ex-Goldman Sachser, right? And we're going to see, as I predicted before, and I'll talk about a little bit more, that Gary Cohn, Goldman Sachs, president's going to take over the Fed in January. So we're going to have a total takeover here of the shadow banking system of the economic policies of the U.S. All right. And, of course, we see the deep political influence of Goldman Sachs and the shadow bankers in the system now. Okay, so we'll get to that shortly here. But, the major theme, and one of the major themes of my book and in of the general analysis, which I'll continue in other ways after this book, is that capitalism reached the threshold here in 2008-09. It's crossed the Rubicon, and it's changed in significant ways that aren't totally clear yet. Excuse me, but nonetheless, are going to become increasingly evident. Okay, so what are those big changes? Well, that's what we'll be talking about from time to time. One of them, of course, is the central bank theme that I just mentioned. Okay, so let's step back a little bit, and let's look at some of the news of note here of the past week. Economic news, to some extent, political news of note. One thing I found very interesting is this report that China has successfully negotiated to slash prescription drug costs for U.S. foreign companies. They've reduced negotiated reduction in drugs to 70%, 70% price reduction. In other words, China has said, okay, you guys want to do business in China, drop these absurd prices. You know, you may get away with that price gouging in the U.S., but you're not going to get away with it here. In other words, the government doing exactly what the U.S. government should be doing, and that is forcing these price gouging companies to reduce these outrageous drug prices. That's just having havoc, economic havoc among people here in the U.S., and undermining, of course, undermining the Social Security system, Part D prescription drugs, raising the cost of Medicaid, and making it more expensive, and therefore giving conservatives a opportunity to attack it, right? A lot of this, you know, these legislative problems underlying it are economic causes here. There's no reason why the U.S. government, and particularly states and even local governments, should not have the right to negotiate.
Okay, so what we were talking about here was prescription drugs and the price of prescription drugs and the fact that China has recently negotiated a deal with U.S. drug companies to slash drug costs 70%, especially on cancer drugs, right? Exactly what the U.S. Congress should be doing, you know, but they won't do it. No reason why they cannot, but they're allowing Americans to have to purchase drugs at three, four, five times on average even, more than they sell these drugs for, these companies sell these drugs for in Canada and other places. And it's really cutting into incomes and consumption. All right, so that's an interesting piece of news here. Also, another piece of news is becoming pretty clear that Janet Yellen, the chair of the Fed, will go in January. She's not going to be replaced. Extended her term by Trump. There's four other candidates who are running for office. Well, not running. It's not an office. Who are competing here amongst themselves for the appointment. One is this guy, John Taylor of Stanford University, author of The Taylor Rule, this absurd idea that nothing should be done except control the money supply and stick to a monetary rule of how much to increase the money supply every year and do nothing else, right? Don't raise, lower rates or anything at the central bank. Just stick to a growth rule, which is absurd, which was tried briefly back in the early 1980s, resulted in interest rates of 20-plus percent, totally shut down the auto and other big-ticket appliance companies and so forth, and construction completely led to a construction crash, housing crash. It was disaster. Disaster back at that time. And he's one of the candidates, by the way. Another is this guy, Glenn Hubbard, a former CEA, Council of Economic Advisors chair under George Bush, and an apologist for the banks. What he did during the Bush years was to say, well, there's no crisis. Pretty much advised other banks and wrote these fake analyses that said it's okay to securitize debt and there's no bank crisis. This was, you know, 2006-07. He was one of the architects of the Iceland banking crash, by the way. So this is a guy who believes totally in deregulation. He's another candidate. This Kevin Warsh, he's a candidate. He was a former Fed governor who left under Yellen here. And he's a good example of this revolving door problem between the Fed and the private banks, you see. These seven Fed governors don't fill out their 14-year terms. They serve 2 or 3 years. They go back into the banking industry. They do their good work for the banks. Revolving door is a big problem at the Federal Reserve now. But the guy who's going to be tapped to replace Yellen, I predict, is going to be Gary Cohn. Gary Cohn is a CEO, former CEO, and of Goldman Sachs. In other words, a shadow bank, right? Very, very influential shadow bank, as we've been talking about. He is now director of Trump's Economic Council, but he's going to be the guy, I predict, that will take over the Fed. Now, that will be pretty much a total takeover of U.S. economic policy by Goldman Sachsmanites, Yeah, Steve Mnuchin, who runs the Treasury now, Treasury Secretary, he's a Goldman Sachser. Bill Dudley, New York Fed, Goldman Sachser. Right, their staffs are all Goldman Sachs people, mostly. And now Gary Cohen, right? So what we got is economic policy by Goldman Sachs going on in this country. So forget any kind of financial regulation. It'll be the end of Dodd-Frank and everything else. And we'll continue, the Fed will continue this free subsidization problem of the private banks that I've been talking about and a theme in my my forthcoming book here. All right, so what else? What else is new? Bill Gross. I don't know if folks know who Bill Gross is, but once termed the global bond king, runs a $2 billion Janus fund, bond fund here, and is pretty critical of what's going on with the central banks and Yellen and others in terms of this eight years now, going on 9 years of free money that the central banks have been providing to the banking industry and investors in turn, and the stock and bond markets in turn. Okay. What Gross has been saying, and I guess he and I are saying something of the same, is that you're creating the next crisis, Federal Reserve, by pumping all this free money into these banks, which leads to all this speculation in financial asset markets, stocks, bonds, derivatives, et cetera, and bubbles, which are going on. And when those bubbles burst and the economy runs into a recession, it becomes a deeper recession. You got another, quote, great recession. You got another crisis. And this time, the next time that this occurs, and it will occur within a couple of years, I predict, it's going to be much worse than 2008-09 because the economy is much weaker than it was going into 2008-09. So Bill Gross has been warning about this. And to quote him, the adherence, quote, of Yellen, the chair of U.S. Fed Central Bank, Bernanke, former chair, Draghi, Mario Draghi, the chair today of the European Central Bank, and Kuroda, Hirohiko Kuroda, who is the chair of the Bank of Japan, quote, continue to quote, among others, to adhere to standard historical models such as the Taylor rule and the Phillips curve has distorted capitalism as we once knew it, with unknown consequences lurking in the shadows of future years. That's a quote from Gross, this global bond fund, big bond fund investor. Well, what's the Taylor rule? Well, we just talked about the Taylor rule, what that was, that nonsense, where all you do is grow the money supply at a certain fixed rate every year and stick to it and don't do anything else. And as we said before, last time that was tried, we had interest rates of 20% plus, and we had a collapse of the economy in 1981-82, pretty much a shutdown of manufacturing and construction and all the problems that led to. Okay, so it's nonsense. That's the Taylor rule. What is the Phillips curve? Well, the Phillips curve is what Janet Yellen has been following and Bernanke has been following as the basis, theoretical basis of their central bank policy. What is that? Well, the Phillips curve is this erroneous, empirically non-substantiated, except temporarily, theory that employment, the level of employment, affects the price level. Originally, this guy Phillips did this study in the late 1950s that looked back at the history of the UK wages and unemployment rates, wage rates and unemployment rates, and found a relationship between the two, that the lower the unemployment rate, the higher the wage rate. Wages increased if unemployment rate decreased. Well, this was a neat idea for Keynesians in the U.S., and in the 60s, they took over this idea and said, well, if wages are the cause of inflation, wage changes lead to price changes, then it must be that inflation is a function of the employment level, or its inverse, the unemployment rate. So if you increase the unemployment rate, you reduce prices through reducing wages. And if you reduce the unemployment rate, say, to 4.5%, which it is now, right, prices will go up because wages will go up, will drive prices up. Well, think about that a minute. That's total nonsense. What's happened here in the last decade or two is wages have not gone up. They can't get the wages to go up. And, of course, prices have not gone up. They've actually slipped and stagnated, not just in the U.S., but even more so in Japan and in Europe. Right? Even as the unemployment rate in the U.S. has been reduced, creating low-quality jobs, to 4.5%, there's been no wage increases and even less price hikes. Well, that relationship, that Phillips curve relationship, has, you know, doesn't exist. Well, actually, at times you could see it in the 70s and 90s, but it disappears. So it really doesn't exist, because this whole idea of the Phillips curve was developed on an industrial capitalist model in the 1950s that had preceded it going back, you know, a century. Well, capitalism has changed. It's become financialized. It's become globalized, right? And the unions have been destroyed. So there's no wage increases going on, except for a small sliver of 10% at the top, maybe. And there's no price increases going on as a result of that, you see. Even if you reduce unemployment rates to 4.5%, it's not causing inflation. Well, but that's what Janet Yellen has been following. She's been saying that, oh, if we get the unemployment rate down to 4.5%, we will get the inflation rate up to our goal of 2%, and we will therefore succeed in achieving our target. So let's just keep interest rates at zero and keep funneling all this free money to our banker buddies, and this will happen. Right, the banker buddies will take the money and loan it to businesses that will invest in real goods and services. You know, plant and equipment and buildings and so forth. Well, it's not happening. As I've said so many times on this show, all that free money and so forth is going offshore, or it's going into financial asset markets, stimulating bubbles in stocks and bonds and other securities, or it's just being hoarded on bank and corporate balance sheets. It's not going into real investment to make real things, to create real jobs for real people. That's a big problem. They call that secular stagnation sometimes, you see. But it really has to do with what's changed in the global financial structure of capitalism. Anyway, we will see what actually happens. But the Phillips curve, which is what the ECB, I mean, the U.S. is based on, and the Taylor rules, you know, what the central banks and the Fed go back and forth between Taylor rules and Phillips curves, you see. There are economic theories here. The theories are used as justifications for what their real objective is, which is to keep subsidizing the private banking system. That's what it's all about. And these economic theories, you know, their policies aren't based on these theories. No, it's just the opposite. The theories are used to justify the policies, which are really driven by these real economic interests. Well, what that means is that these economic theories are not really scientific. They are ideologies created to justify the interests and policies implemented in the interest of a certain segment of society. That's what it is. See, it's Taylor rules, Phillips curves. This is pure economic ideology now. Neither conform to reality, you know, which is the test of science. the central banks, as Bill Gross has pointed out, have pumped trillions and trillions of dollars into the private banks. My estimate's $15 trillion from what's called direct bond buying quantitative easing alone. $15 trillion across the five major central banks in the world. The U.S. Fed, the Bank of England, European Central Bank, Bank of Japan, People's Bank of China, and all the other smaller banks in Europe that national banks, central banks that aren't affiliated with the ECB, you know, like in Switzerland and Sweden, places like that. Okay. And now, of course, as we said in previous shows, the ECB, the Fed has indicated it may start trying to reduce its $4.5 billion balance sheet as a result of just this QE, direct bond buying. Now, there's been other traditional bond buying going on at the same time this direct bond buying has been going on. So it's even more than $4.5 trillion. The balance sheet is $4.5 trillion. And it's talking to selling this off. Well, talk so far is like $5 billion a month. Okay, if it sells off $5 billion a month, how long is that going to take to sell off $4.5 trillion? Quite some time. We're talking about years and years, maybe decades. Well, we'll see, because we'll have an announcement probably in September by the Fed. Unless the economy softens significantly, then the Fed won't even sell off what it's got. The balance sheets aren't going to be sold off very much. I mean, what do we got? We got nearly $4.7 trillion in Europe, $4.5 trillion here in the U.S., over $4 trillion, almost $5 trillion in Japan, and the balance sheets in China over $5 trillion. You know, so. Gosh, you got $15 to $20 trillion here of what amounts to central banks subsidizing the private banks. Because what that means is they are buying, with that $15 to $20 trillion, they are buying the debts of the private banks and putting it on their central banks' balance sheets. That's all they're doing. They're just transferring the debt to their own balance sheet. That's subsidization, you see. That's what that is. And now the ECB is even backing off of talking. It was once talking about maybe doing that, but they're backing off now. And as they back off, our rates are rising through market forces here in Europe. And as rates rise, so does the value of the currency. So the euro is rising. And if the euro rises, which it is, that means exports from Europe will decline, their GDP will decline, and the price targets, you know, real goods and services prices will drift back towards stagnation or deflation, you see. That's the contradiction they can't get out of. the Bank of England has no plans to sell off any of its balance sheet, and the Bank of Japan is accelerating raising his balance sheet, buying not only bonds, but private bonds, corporate bonds, buying stocks. Talk about subsidization of finance capital. You know, in Japan, they're even buying the stocks of companies to keep the stock prices up. Okay, so that's a fundamental change that's occurred in the global capitalist system. The central banks now are propping up the system like never before. And so are the governments, you see. Propping up the capitalists. How are they doing it? Well, with subsidies, increased subsidies, and most importantly, with big tax cuts for corporations and investors. And we're going to get our latest round here from the U.S. Congress very shortly this year. So this, you know, the subsidization of the system by the state is growing by leaps and bounds because the system itself can no longer apparently sustain itself at least at the rate that it once did. Here's another report that substantiates that view here. The Bank of International Settlements in Geneva, sometimes called the Bank of Central Bank of Central Bankers, more of a research arm for central bankers, right, has recently come out a report that showed that since the 1980s, global trade had been accelerating every year. You know, 1980, global trade, the value of total global trade was 25% of global GDP. Okay. By 2007, the value of global trade had increased to 60% of world GDP. So in other words, global trade, globalization, as they sometimes say, was driving the capitalist system in terms of growth. But that came to a halt in 2008-9, another indication of 2008-9 as being a critical threshold. Okay, well, what happened in 2008-9? Well, global trade as a percent of GDP, that 60%, right, in 2007, collapsed. Oh, but it recovered much of that collapse, you know, in 2010. It was like a big V-shape down and back to previous levels. However, since 2010, right, it's been stagnant. And since 2014-15, it's been drifting lower. Global trade as a percent of global GDP. This is the first time that global trade in the last few years has been growing less than GDP. And GDP has been slowing, you see. Global GDP has been slowing down, particularly in the advanced economies. And global trade is slowing down even more. So global trade is growing even less. That means global trade is not driving GDP anymore, which means something fundamentally has changed since 2008-9. Capitalism is no longer expanding geographically, which was the key to this growth period during the neoliberal regimes, which come into play here, you know, in the U.S. and U.K. and globally in late 1970s, 1980s. And part of neoliberalism was this drive to globalization and financialization as a way of getting global capitalism back on the growth track that it slipped from in the 1970s. Well, it looks like that whole strategy has collapsed. Now, we're not getting any more a increase in global trade. It's growing slower than GDP. Well, that's fundamental. It's fundamental. Okay. Which kind of then leads to this idea that the central banks have stepped in to subsidize the system, which has been slowing and can't get back on the growth track. Does that mean that neoliberalism is at its end? Maybe. Maybe. Obama couldn't put it back together again. And now, you know, what's happening with all this chaos here in policy with Trump is a good example of, you know, the Humpty Dumpty of neoliberalism fell off the wall in 2008-9, and they can't put the pieces back together again. Yeah. I mean, the proof in whether they have is what happens and what is happening to not only national growth rates, but the global growth rates here. And global trade being a major driver of that in the 19 to 2008 frame doesn't appear to be able to drive the system further any longer. Fundamental and certainly of interest. You can also see indications of the threshold idea in what's happening in the labor markets, what's happening with wages and therefore incomes. We have a major shift of incomes from wage earners to capital incomes. All right, so how have they achieved this? Well, one way they've achieved this is to destroy the unions, which they've done not only in the U.S., but in Europe and elsewhere as well. Unions always played the role of slowing down the attack on wages when recessions occurred, and then when growth followed recessions, the unions would recoup their losses, you see. But the unions haven't been able to play that role in any significant sense since the 1980s. Well, it's been in stages that it's occurred. So the unions had to be destroyed effectively as a countervailing economic force, which they have been. Also, what had to have happened and has happened is the Democratic Party, which provided social wage gains, had to be neutralized or co-opted or integrated within the capitalist parties and the capitalist system, which they have been. I mean, just look at the Labour Party in Britain trying to reestablish itself now as independent, but under Gordon Brown, you know, totally, and Tony Blair totally became an appendage of capitalist interests, no longer tried to establish social benefits. Throughout Europe, you see the same thing. Socialist Party in France completely collapsed now because it's played the same role. The Democratic Party was the same thing. You know, it's a kind of quasi-social democratic party, at least it was, but it became really the alternating wing of the corporate party of America. Okay, so you got to destroy the unions. You got to transform the social democratic parties, which has happened. You got to convert pensions from a source of wage deferred wage increases for workers to a profit center system, which has occurred. But to do that, you got to privatize them, which they've done. Converted them from defined benefit plans to 401ks. Okay, you got to shift income from retirees and investors. You know, mom and pop, grandma. CD, certificate of deposit, savings, you know, shift that income to the bankers occurred with this zero interest rate thing. You got to destroy real-time jobs and replace them with contingent jobs, and those part-time temp jobs. If you look at Europe, 60-70%, maybe more, of all the jobs created since 2008-09 have been contingent, temporary. Part-time jobs. And then the policymakers use that as an excuse to attack labor. You know, the part-time contingent job folks don't have the rights. So what we got to do is open up what's left of the full-time jobs and lower the bar for everybody. So we have this huge increase in contingent jobs in the U.S. as well. The figures don't totally reflect that accurately, I don't believe. Okay, so what else happens with the labor markets? Well, we have this big surge in independent contract work, over 10 million in the U.S., or, quote, independent contractors. That's been a development trend driven by corporations as well. They get rid of full-time regular people and hire them back as independent contractors. Don't have to pay them any benefits. They work longer hours. Lower costs for hiring, termination, no paid leave, and so forth. No unions to worry about because by law they are exempt from representing independent contractors. A good example is truck drivers in the ports, you know. They work 12, 14 hours a day, and they have to pay for their capital, for the capital. In other words, it's not trucks owned by trucking companies anymore. It's trucks owned by these individuals. They got to provide their own capital. The whole Uber thing is a good example of that, how capitalism is shifting the cost of capital provisioning and capital costs to the labor. To labor itself, to workers. That's what Uber's all about, right? All I do is control, Uber controls the software and access to the customer skims, you know, 80% of the profits off the top and has no cost of goods, you know, except their software, and lets the workers provide the cost of goods. Well, it's a very profitable business model, right? And that's all part of this independent contractor. Oh, and tech companies, well, they destroy all kinds of businesses and replace it with this new place for less people. And at the same time, they bring over all these foreign skilled people, H-1B visas here, to increase the competition, keep the wages down, you see. And now what they're doing is the no paid internships. This is really disgusting going on in labor markets. Even in the tech industry, you want to get a job, you have to produce something for them, and they don't pay you for it. You see, you either engage in these competitions to show what you can do online, and of course, you don't own that stuff. It's not copyrighted, and the corporations steal it from you. All right? Or even worse, you get hired by a tech company, and you work for free for 6 months. They don't pay you a penny. You work for free. You know, and the whole idea is, well, we're going to pick the best workers. So you work like a busy bee, like hell, you know, to produce something for the company. Hopefully we get a job with all the other interns trying to do the same. And then what these tech companies do is that before the 6 months or when 6 months is up, they lay you off and hire new interns, you see. So it's just sort of a rolling exploitation mill for skilled trade, skilled work. That's the latest. And then free trade, what does that do? Well, that drives down the what's called the export-import wage differential. So that drives down wages. And now we got all these kind of indications that not only free trade is destroying jobs, but automation increasingly destroying jobs. You know, this is a kind of a bad secret that this whole process, the business model shift by tech companies, you know, internet companies destroying jobs and not creating as many new jobs, but automation in general destroying jobs. A recent report, Citibank Research, right? Recent report just came out. 2030 jobs will be impacted. Percent of the job. Food service. Now, this is an area where a lot of part-time temp jobs have been created in food service. A lot of those are going to go away, particularly they're going to go away. You know, all these entry-level retail jobs, even at minimum wage or barely above, that people start out in often, and in large parts of the country, that's all that's left after they've deindustrialized. Those going away now. In transport, 75%. Well, that's the Uber effect, right? In wholesale industry, 66. Even in manufacturing, 62% of the jobs are going to be impacted by, and construction, 59% will be impacted by automation. A lot of the jobs that exist today, even in contingent markets, are going to be gone. I think I would argue, too, as globalization has slowed down and the ability to move these jobs offshore slows down with it, you're going to see a further intensification in automation. At the same time, we see minimum wage not being raised. Federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. You think you can live on $14,000 a year? Particularly in a city. And now we have this tax shift going on, right? We saw the fight over taxes, which was really at the heart of this ACA. You know, the reason why the Kochs and all the others were pushing Tea Partiers and all the other services here to get rid of the ACA was because of the $600 billion of tax on wealthy investors and companies and businesses was the way most of this was being paid under the ACA. That's why they hated it. Oh, but now they haven't been able to repeal ACA, right? So now they're just going to go after a major tax change. And we'll be talking about that. You know, the next phase in the historic tax shift going on here in the U.S. is coming. It's coming. Another interesting area of reporting here reports productivity slowing. Productivity slowing down dramatically. historical average of annual productivity gains in the U.S. is 2%. Well, what about the last decade? What's it been in the last decade? 0.4, 0.4%. 0.4. So it's dropped 80%, you might say. It's nearly collapsed. Growth rates collapsed. One of the reasons why you're not getting wage increases, and you won't. And that's when productivity collapses, you know, labor costs rise for companies, and they take it out on wages, you see. Or they cut benefits. And that's both of those things are happening, right? So why is productivity collapsing? Because the investment is not flowing into making real things. It's going offshore. It's going into services where you can't really estimate productivity growth. That's more of an art than a science. Right? And it's shifting to financial asset investing, which was the main theme of my previous book, Systemic Fragility in a Global Economy, that capitalism, again, has crossed this threshold in 2008-09, and actually was doing this even before, under the neoliberal period, of shifting investing to financial assets, stocks, bonds, derivatives, and so forth, rather than into real things. Well, why were they doing that? Because it's more profitable. And this whole process created this new global finance capital elite, about 200,000 people with annual income gains of $25 million. Now, this is the new capitalist power segment in the world as capitalism is transitioning from industrial focus to a more financial focus. All right? And, of course, that accompanies that is the rise of the shadow banks and capital markets, as we call them, right, as a source of finance, not just banks making loans, but shadow banks, capital markets, equity markets, bond markets, et cetera, online markets, crowdfunding, all that stuff. Shadow banks now, in other words, non-traditional banks, you know, not Bank America, not Chase, et cetera, but shadow banks, equity fund firms, BlackRock, all those, although Carlyle, all those players, right? They control more assets now, investable assets, than commercial banks. Commercial banks are becoming economic dinosaurs. That's why they were trying to transition these commercial banks into shadow banks themselves back before 2008-09. If you look at Europe and Japan, who are in worst economic shape and where you have most of your non-performing bank loans, it's because those economies are driven, investment is driven more by banks lending, by bank loans, you see, the banking sector. The shadow banks and the capital markets are not as well developed in Japan and Europe, and that's why they have a bigger non-performing bank loan problem over there. We're talking about trillions of dollars. You know, globally, non-performing loans are probably around $10 trillion, about half of that in China, but the rest of that mostly in Japan and Europe. You hear about it periodically about the Italian banks, you know, or the Spanish banks or Portuguese banks in trouble. Well, it's a problem all across Europe, concentrated in those areas, particularly Italy. But non-performing bank loans are a big problem. That's because in those regions there, the finance system is more traditional banking. And the traditional banking can't compete with capital markets and shadow banks. And we see these shadow bankers increasing their influence politically as well. What do you think we got fiscal austerity for? Well, they want the free money. They want monetary policy to drive the whole show. They don't want spending on providing income for households. No, no. That's a bottom-up way to profits. They prefer the top-down. Give us the free money, and maybe we'll spend a little bit on real investment that creates jobs for households. Maybe. Well, you know, you see Goldman Sachs, as I said before, now pretty much controlling the U.S. government, economic policy. Congressional committees are tied in because of all the money tied into these banks and contributions and lobbyists and so forth, right? The Supreme Court, you know, the last two appointees to the Supreme Court have been corporate lawyers, agency heads, you know, bankers controlling Fed Next, right? And the group of 30, there's a group of 30 major bankers and finance capitalists around the world, and they include the central bankers, key central bankers, who are key to determining a lot of this monetary policy around the world. Group of 30, you know? I mean, you hear people talk about the Bilderbergs, you know, and the Trilateral Commission and so forth, you know? I mean, the decisions are really made with this group of 30. The European Union Ombudsman here has recently filed a charge against them, trying to find out more about what they're doing. Well, what they're doing is coming up with strategies and economic strategies and programs to shift income to support global elites, economic elites, you know, who need to be subsidized now. The U.S. alone, $6 trillion since 2009 has been distributed by corporations and banks in the form of dividends and stock buybacks to their investors. $6 trillion distributed. And, of course, they cut all the taxes. We extended the George Bush tax cuts under Obama, $5 trillion more, and they were primarily dividend stock, financial asset, corporate investment tax cuts. Right, we've cut taxes $10 trillion under Bush and Obama for corporations and investors, and now that's going to accelerate. $2 trillion alone proposed by Trump here. We'll see how that comes out in the tax legislation this year. Yeah, I mean they're funneling the money through the tax system hand over fist to the wealthiest 1%. See. So it's not just the Federal Reserve central banks that have been co-opted and captured. You know? It's the Congress. It's the legislative branch, the executive branches as well. Okay. Over $10 trillion distributed or hoarded since 2008-09. There's been recovery, but it's all been focused on the top end, right? They're subsidizing whole system. McKinsey had a recent report here. Household real incomes flat or falling. You know, how have what's been happening with household incomes? Right? How many are stagnant or falling of households? You know, in the U.S. we got maybe under 30 million households. Right? Household real incomes. You know, last decade. 80% of U.S. households' real incomes are either flat or declining. 80%. Well, that's the entire working class, you see. No, 80%. In Europe, 75%. Among all the advanced economies, on a weighted average here, according to McKinsey, 70%. In other words, throughout this Western global capitalist region here, Europe, North America, Japan, 70% of the incomes are declining, flat or declining. Well, that's the working class, that said bottom 70%, right? Flat or declining. So, you know, you look at places like even China, and all the incomes are rising. Well, it's all skewed to the high end. Okay, well, that's our review here of some of the keys this week, and I apologize for the mix-up here on the phone call. All right, Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.